I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The death toll from Sunday's earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean climbed dramatically today. As many as 44,000 people are now confirmed dead in 11 countries. And incredible images are emerging. Mourners in Sri Lanka digging graves with their bare hands. A 20-month-old baby found alive on a floating mattress in Malaysia. The Sri Lankan Air Force rescued former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl from his vacation hotel today. The grandson of the King of Thailand was not as fortunate. He died in Phuket. And as international relief efforts get underway, health epidemics like cholera may kill thousands more. One of the worst hit areas was Aceh province at the northern tip of Indonesia's Sumatra Island. In one village alone, 10,000 people were reported killed. Well, joining us by cell phone from the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, is Tom McCauley. He writes for the Christian Science Monitor. And Tom, the earthquake itself took place about 150 miles off of Sumatra. Indonesia's official death toll now stands at 19,000. Tell us about the devastation there.
The vice president, who just returned from Aceh yesterday, claims that the death toll may be as high as 25,000. Once the full extent of the damage is known, a lot of the victims will be along the western coast of Aceh, which is currently without communications. A lot of the communities there are small fishing-based communities, many on tiny islands with often not more than a couple of hundred people.
Tell us about Aceh and how it's particularly affecting that region.
Okay, Aceh is a devout Islamic province of about 4.2 million people. It's been racked with a separatist rebellion since the mid-70s, and the government's been cracking down with various degrees of brutality, which intensified in May 2003. With a full-scale assault and a declaration of emergency status, military emergency. That military emergency has killed a lot of international aid and an infrastructure that would have been there otherwise. So a big part of the problem is, at the moment, in these few days, has been literally international and foreign aid agencies simply setting up. That's equally been the case with foreign journalists who haven't been allowed back until just recently.
How is that region handling all the dead? Can they even bury their dead?
Burying the dead is a problem. And a disaster management expert today said that any government systems would fail with a disaster on this magnitude. And you're looking at an area with no system in place. Corpses are being dredged out of rivers. They've had to ship in tractors to dig makeshift mass graves because the amount of decomposing bodies, particularly in the tropics, is creating a danger of epidemics and diseases, cholera, typhoid, and others. A TV news report today quoted a local saying that there were more dead people than there were people helping. So the logistics of managing the dead bodies is unfortunately a grim reality.
We understand that in the provincial capital, Banda Aceh, the waters there reached as far as 10 miles inland. There were reports of one hospital being completely inundated, all the patients inside drowned. How are people in Indonesia receiving this news?
They're looking for loved ones. Those that can are trying to assist with the relief effort. And the reports that are coming in just suggest a state of shock. People are simply trying to survive. Food supplies have been disrupted, transport supplies have been disrupted, and there's no power. It really is a post-apocalyptic situation in Aceh right now.
Tom, we're hearing and learning that maybe as much as one-third of the victims of the tsunami might have been children, that they were particularly vulnerable.
I can believe it. When you go into kampongs, which is a local name for these small communities, a lot of the population are children. Children would have been playing by the beaches, 8 a.m. on a Sunday. And as the waters receded, a lot of people ran to pick up fishes.
Tom, tell us more about that, because we have this image, of this almost biblical image of the water receding out of sight. You say people were running out to get the fish?
That's right. Bear in mind, these poor fishing communities that will often spend a lot of time and resources trying to fish. So when the waves went back, and there's no warning about what that might mean, a lot of people simply ran to pick up the booty. One Achenese man was reporting seeing the waters recede back, seeing fishes flopping on the sand and people rushing forth, as he heard a rumbling on the horizon and a wall of white water that toppled the ship. Aceh is an Islamic community, but it's also fairly superstitious. A lot of people, a lot of Indonesians are seeing this as an omen. A lot of local Acehnese are seeing this as some sort of sign of divine anger. So the biblical analogy is an apt one, although we know, of course, this is not caused by not caused directly by the Almighty, but by shifting tectonic plates.
Tom, I'm looking at a map. Banda Aceh is on the tip of the island of Sumatra in the Indonesian islands. It's right across the water from Phuket, which extends down from Thailand. To the left, to the west, I think it would be, I see Sri Lanka. All these areas that we now know, above Sri Lanka, Madras, India, all the areas that we now know were devastated. Did the quake itself do any damage, or did they feel the quake, or was it just the tsunami?
No. Banda Aceh, the capital, was actually suffered a lot of earthquake damage. There were reports across the city of Sumatra feeling huge tremors. It was a 9 on the Richter scale, which is the biggest earthquake this century, and certainly the biggest in the world since 1964.
Is there a sense of aid or relief coming, Tom?
It's difficult to say. Even Acehnese families in Jakarta haven't been able to talk to their loved ones back home. So, you know, news crews, agencies are having a hard time communicating with people on the ground. So I couldn't say that. I couldn't say that for sure. I mean, in fact, you know, in remote communities, it probably feels as though they've been abandoned. It's only really today that the relief operation is starting. But at the moment, it's really bedlam in Banda Aceh. It's very difficult for aid agencies to operate. And that'll be probably the case for the rest of the week.
Tom McCauley writes for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been speaking to us from Jakarta in Indonesia. The epicenter of the earthquake that produced the tsunami was right off the coast of this Indonesian island of Sumatra. Tom, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin. All the best.
Well, another area hard hit by the devastating tsunamis, Sri Lanka, the small island country off the southernmost tip of India. Upwards of 19,000 people are reported dead. And here in Massachusetts, members of the Sri Lankan community are rallying to help. Joining us on the line from Chelmsford, Massachusetts, is Bevis Pieris. He's of the Sri Lanka Association of New England. And Bevis, what was your first reaction when you heard about the tsunamis?
My first reaction was my sister. Make sure she was okay. And the tragedy was so large that one couldn't even comprehend what was happening.
Did you reach your sister?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and is she all right?
Yeah. I was lucky because I called about 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, and the lines were not that busy, so I got through.
Yeah. What did she tell you about what happened there?
Well, she was not affected because she's in Colombo.
That's the capital.
The capital. But she had been hearing stories, and she was preparing with her church group to go out and cook food and distribute some food out to the area that were affected.
Well, now we know you've been on the phone since then trying to raise support for family and friends and people back in Sri Lanka.
That's right.
How large a Sri Lankan population is there in the United States?
I just can't give you a figure, but I remember seeing somewhere about maybe about 10,000 or maybe 20,000, I don't know. The population in New England is most probably 300 to 500, maybe.
Yeah. And how are they responding?
They're responding very well. Right now, we have about 2 or 3 programs, the Sri Lankan community, not the association itself, but the community itself. And then we have, on our own, set up a bank account where we're collecting some money to send through the Oxfam America.
Sri Lanka is, as I said, an island nation.
It's an island nation.
You know the country well. You know the landscape. I can't imagine the images that are coming to your mind of what must have happened.
Yeah. In fact, I was there in December, and I visited the East Coast, a place called Batticaloa, which I understand has been very badly hit. And there's another place called Trincomalee, which is in the northeast. That's also very badly hit. I don't know whether the casualties from that area even been reported as yet because they're so isolated. And also there was a civil conflict there. Therefore, the infrastructure has been destroyed as well. So I don't know how much information is getting out.
We understand in neighboring countries, the fishermen who went out to sea never returned. Sri Lanka's right off the coast of India,
yeah,
where several, the Nicobar Islands, the Andaman Islands are thought to be gone.
Yeah, yeah, and the Maldives Islands too, because they are just 1 meter above sea level. But I don't think they have suffered a human casualty rate as bad as Sri Lanka has. It's a Sunday morning type of thing, and everybody would have been on the beach, and the fishermen would have been out. And on the East Coast, there's a group of fishermen who go out on the sea, and they put stilts on the fish off the stilts. What happened to them?
Mm. You're doing a lot of work here, Bevis, to rally support.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go back?
Not really. I think the best we could do is stay here and try and help as much as we can. I'm a little bit older. I'm in my 60s. Mm. And I'm also physically handicapped.
Mm.
And I most probably be in the way of any things I would try to do there.
Yeah. And you're doing the work from here.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is very important to try and get rally support, not only from Sri Lankans, but from other countrymen too.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about Americans of all nationalities.
Yeah. Well, and we'll let people know how they can help. But in the meantime, how else is the community reacting? Are people able to get through on the phone now? Have people lost family or their family they can't find? What else is happening for the community here?
I have been talking to a few other people. Some people have been able to contact their relatives. And some people have not been able to contact all their relatives, but, you know, what can I say? I mean, you know, your heart goes out to all these people.
Well, Bevis, earlier you mentioned a civil conflict. It's a decades-long battle between two ethnic groups with their own language, their own religion. There's the mostly Buddhist Sinhalese and the Hindu Tamils. The Tamil Tiger rebels run a virtual independent state in Sri Lanka. And early reports say the rescue effort in Sri Lanka is hurt because these two groups, always on the verge of war, aren't working together. Are you hopeful that will change?
This is something that's going to transcend any nationality, any ethnic or religious dispute in any part of Asia. This is too big for that kind of stuff.
Well, you're with the Sri Lanka Association here in New England, but there's also the Boston Tamil Association of New England. Have you been able to bridge that divide?
The Sri Lanka Association of New England is made up of all groups of people. So we don't have any problems, and we have a lot of ties with the people in the Tamil Association.
Mm.
And we are always trying to reach to each other to help in every way possible.
And so that's happening now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bevis Pierce is with the Sri Lanka Association of New England. Bevis, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Robin.
And for more information on his relief effort, go to our website, here-now.org. Just ahead, getting early warnings on tsunamis. And later in the program, the biggest health stories of 2004 besides the looming health crisis in the wake of the tsunami. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our coverage of the tsunami disaster in the Indian Ocean. There is an international tsunami warning system in place to protect people living along the Pacific Rim, and many say that lives could have been saved had a similar warning system existed in the Indian Ocean. But is that feasible? We turn now to Dr. Charles McCreary. He's the director of the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Honolulu, and he joins us from Honolulu. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you.
And I know you're answering a lot of questions today. Let's just get to one quickly. London's independent newspaper says that within 15 minutes of the earthquake on Sunday, your center sent an alert to 26 countries, including Thailand and Indonesia, but couldn't reach the right people. In fact, you were quoted as saying, "We tried, but we don't have contacts in our address book for anyone in that particular part of the world." Now, you know that readers of that quote might say, "Why not? Why not?"
Well, I think that quote has been misinterpreted in some respects. What was really intended was that because there's no formal warning system in that area, then normally the way a tsunami warning system has to work is that you alert the critical assigned government agencies and that there's an infrastructure in place to go from them and get a warning down to the lowest possible level in a quick amount of time and have the public know what to do with that information to evacuate. And that's what was not set up in that region.
Mm. But you know, the people are saying, and I want to check the facts on this, didn't the wave hit some parts of the world there 2 hours after the earthquake?
Yes, that's true.
And so couldn't even a phone call to some government agency maybe prompt a phone call to a hotel on a coast and save lives?
Well, the truth is we did not know there was such a tsunami in the Indian Ocean at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We have no sea level gauges in the Indian Ocean to monitor for a tsunami, and our preliminary estimate of magnitude for that earthquake was an 8.0, which from our experiences in the Pacific, an 8.0 is likely to generate a local tsunami that would have been destructive to Sumatra within minutes mm-hmm. of the earthquake, but nothing that would have spread out from there. And so we were completely unaware of the huge magnitude of this disaster, really, until we started receiving casualty reports from the news agencies,
right.
Like I say, because there's no water level instruments in the Indian Ocean that we could monitor the way we do in the Pacific.
Right, and to remind people, tsunamis travel underwater. Well, I want to bring in one of your colleagues to join us now to talk more about how the system does work. He is Eddie Bernard, director of the Pacific Marine Environmental Lab in Seattle. And Eddie, welcome. Eddie, welcome. Is Eddie there? Well, while we're getting Eddie to the phone, back to you and ask, sure. How does the system work? It was created about 20 years ago. How does it predict a tsunami?
Well, actually, our center has been here since 1949.
Ah.
But the way the system works is we monitor seismic sensors around the globe, and based on seismic signals from earthquakes, we can detect any large earthquake usually within 3 or 4 minutes, and then within 10 or 15 minutes, we will have determined a location and preliminary magnitude for the earthquake. So based on those parameters, we know whether there's the possibility a tsunami might have been generated. And following that, we monitor sea level sensors, and well, in the Pacific, we have about 100 coastal gauges and 6 deep ocean gauges, and from those data is how we confirm that a tsunami was generated by the earthquake and begin to estimate the severity of the tsunami.
And what happens? Do alarms go off on beaches and in villages? How does it go from there?
Well, each country has its own way of alerting its populations, and this is a challenge for many regions, because to alert people about a tsunami, the mechanism needs to be fast, and people need to know what to do right away.
Mm-hmm.
In Hawaii, we do have a system of sirens that cover most of our beaches in Hawaii, but in many other areas around the Pacific, that's siren systems are not possible.
Charles McCreary, he's a director of the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Honolulu. I want to, in the couple minutes we have, see if Eddie Bernard is there. Former director. Eddie, you know there's talk of placing such a system in the Indian Ocean. In fact, there have been talks up to a couple of weeks before this earthquake. But it would cost millions of dollars for an event that is so rare. Do you think that this is actually going to happen, and should it happen?
Well, I think I don't know where you got your cost estimates about any expansion of the warning system into the Indian Ocean, but there are several levels that you could approach this at, none of which, I mean, the zeroth level would be one of coordination, which the cost would be very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first and foremost priority should be educating the populations of the Indian Ocean that they are in tsunami-threatened areas. The fine work of the Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission of the United Nations has for the last 40 years has been publishing materials that have been distributed to developing countries. all those materials just need to be translated into the local dialects and distributed, and scientists need to get into the field and help educate the populations as to the kind of threat that they deal with. That approach could save many lives, but it would not be real expensive. After you do something like that, then you start to talk about what are the other capabilities you need to put in place, technological things such as tide gauges and seismometers. But that's premature. You need to, first of all, assess the nature of the hazard for the Indian Ocean, mm-hmm. and then move forward after you've got an educational system put in place so that when a warning does come, people know how to respond.
Well, Eddie Bernard, I'm sorry, we just have a few seconds left. I'm sorry our phone line fell through with you, but we thank you both. It would have prevented, education, it seems, would have prevented youngsters from running out to gather the fish as the ocean receded and saved a lot of lives. Dr. Charles McGurry, Director of the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Honolulu, Hawaii. Eddie Bernard, Director of the Pacific Marine Environmental Lab in Seattle. Thank you both for joining us.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. Robin Young, excuse me, it's here and now. Well, Sunday's tsunami in the Indian Ocean, which, as we've been reporting, has killed at least 44,000 people and set the stage for disease and dehydration, will surely send editors scrambling to revise their year-end lists of the biggest news stories. It'll probably also find a home on the lists of the health stories in 2004. One such list was compiled by researchers at Harvard Medical School before Sunday's quake. So joining us in the studio with the other news from the world of health, Dr. Anthony Komaroff, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Doctor.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Now, you've identified these top 10 health stories of the year. They range from new guidelines on cholesterol to issues surrounding health insurance. Of those top 10, the top item, cholesterol and revised government guidelines. Tell us about that.
Yes, especially around the statin drugs, which are the most popular drugs to lower cholesterol.
Lipitor and drugs like that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Until the new guidelines, for people who were at particularly high risk from heart disease or who had heart disease, the recommendation was that the bad cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, be below 100. New studies this last year showed that at least for people who were having a heart attack or related heart problems, that getting it even lower, down below 70, was prudent.
Okay, well, that's that shocked quite a few people, I'm sure. We move on to the safety of prescription drugs. We just mentioned Lipitor. How big was Merck yanking Vioxx off the market this past September? There have been so many other drug stories since then that, you know, it's easy to forget. How big a story was that this past year?
I think it was a very big story. For one thing, it was about, I think, $2.5 billion drug, so it was big in that respect. Many, many people were on it. Something like 80 million people had taken Vioxx. And it was big also because it pointed out some flaws in our system of drug approval. And that is that we do a very good job of evaluating a drug before it reaches the market, but a very bad job of evaluating what's happening with drugs once they're on the market. Mm-hmm. Two things happen. One, they get used for people who really don't need them just because they're the latest and the greatest. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is there are side effects that are rare that they weren't noticed before the drug hit the market. But when it starts being taken by 80 million people, you can begin to see them if you have a system in place to find them. But we don't have a very good system.
think there's going to be any kind of overhaul of the FDA in the new year?
I would be very surprised if there are not some changes in the FDA.
And moving on to other items on your list, walking as a prevention for dementia.
Yeah. I mean, everyone knows that exercise is good for you, and a lot of people know that even a brisk walk for a mile and a half or two and a half an hour has health benefits. But I think what people don't know is how much benefit you can get from exercise. A lot of evidence that you can reduce your risks of heart disease and of diabetes, for example, by 30 to 50% just by a regular brisk walk. There's no pill that doctors have ever invented that can give you that much benefit. New information this year was that such a regular brisk walk can also reduce your risk of dementia. So walking is so easy to do for most people, doesn't require a lot of hassle the way jogging can, and the magnitude of the benefits are really enormous.
I'm going to tick off a couple of other items on your list that have to do with cancer.
Okay.
You mentioned the latest cancer drugs, which target abnormalities particular to cancer cells as opposed to destroying all cells. That's good news in the past year. PSA screenings, the screening for prostate cancer, what's always been important is the number. Now it's also important how much that number has increased over a year. PSA velocity, I think, is the word.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so that there's that item. And then another item on your list, cloning for stem cells. As you write, this means two controversial research paths cross. As the presidential candidates this past year debate stem cell research, South Korean scientists announced that they've created 30 cloned human embryos and harvested stem cells from them. To what end?
The idea is definitely not to produce a human being. But it's the same technique that was used to produce the sheep Dolly, where you take a cell from an adult animal and grow an embryo that contains the genes of that animal. The idea, the purpose of it, is to collect what are called embryonic stem cells, these magical cells that can turn into nearly any cell in the body. And we want that because most diseases involve the death of cells. A heart attack involves the death of heart cells. Alzheimer's disease involves the death of certain kinds of brain cells. If you could have a cell that would grow back into the heart cells or the brain cells that were lost, you would have an enormously powerful potential treatment. Mm-hmm. This kind of stem cell research does not involve, and in fact most people would ban, any attempt to grow a human being. It's the technique just to collect the cells that are in an embryo that people are excited about.
Well, and we should say, you say we want that, meaning society, I assume,
yeah,
because of the benefit of these stem cells. But there are still people, despite what you just said, who don't want that because it's still producing an embryo, and there are people who feel that an embryo should never be destroyed for the stem cells, even if it's cloned.
What the British have done has said, if you produce the embryo but do not put it into a womb, that's fine because it cannot possibly grow. But if you put it into a womb, that's a felony and subject to jail.
Isn't it interesting? So that's how they're handling that.
Yes.
And, of course, in this country, there are people who are adopting embryos,
right,
that, for instance, are left at fertility clinics so that, again, the future of that embryo is not in jeopardy.
Exactly.
So that's still a very controversial topic in this country.
It's very, and the ethical questions are very real. Mm-hmm. But the power to do good is also very real, and as a society, we have to come to grips with both things.
Mm-hmm. All right, that, of course, a huge health story from the past year, but I want to touch on one that struck a lot of people, perhaps closer to home. This flu vaccine shortage this past winter pointed out to a lot of Americans that they don't have easy access to flu vaccine. Is there going to be some move to change that, to, you know, to encourage American manufacturers and to encourage more American companies to make the vaccine, which I guess now isn't very profitable for them?
There is not any serious congressional effort to do that, but there are a lot of people who think that that's what should be done.
Dr. Anthony Komaroff, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter at Harvard Medical School, with their top 10 health stories of the year. Dr. Komaroff, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Robin. It's been a pleasure to be here.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message. That's 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Still to come, he's big, he's yellow, he's four-ish, but he's very, very smart. The wisdom of Big Bird. There's more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Americans have gotten used to having their baggage x-rayed at airports. Well, now the federal government is proposing x-raying humans. Here and Now health contributor Judy Foreman is here now to tell us more about this new anti-terrorism effort. And Judy, you write in your syndicated column today that an x-ray is already being used in some instances to screen travelers.
Yes, incoming travelers, suspicious incoming travelers who might be bringing in dope or something. And it's also used in prisons to look for contraband and plastic weapons and things like that.
Well, let's be clear for people who say, well, wait a minute, I go through that thing, that's a metal detector. We're talking about x-rays, which would have radiation.
That's right. Very small doses of radiation, but radiation, which would give the person looking at the x-ray a beautiful picture of your naked body in all its glory.
Well, let's talk about that, because you see your baggage go through and get x-rayed and it shows up. You see all, you know, everything that's in it in this sort of fuzzy image. Would there be that same image of you?
Yes.
Showing what?
Showing your love handles, your underwire bra, and anything else you care to imagine.
So obviously there are some privacy issues being raised.
There's some big-time privacy issues, yes.
But medical issues as well. Let's talk about those. We get radiation all the time when we go to the dentist and take x-rays, when we fly.
That's right. But when you go to the doctor for an x-ray or you for a chest x-ray or whatever, you're taking on that risk voluntarily because you know the risks and you know that you personally can benefit. You're not just benefiting society at large. And yes, when we fly, you get much more radiation than you would get from these so-called backscatter radiations. So this would be a tiny addition to the radiation we already get just from flying and living on Earth.
Well, so tell us about the method that would be used, backscatter.
Yes, backscatter. Well, I had never heard of that, frankly, until this column. But the x-rays come out of a machine and then bounce back toward the machine, which means they don't penetrate your body very deeply.
Which is, for instance, what happens when you get a CAT scan that goes all the way through the body and takes a picture on the other side.
Exactly.
So this is backscatter. How powerful is that?
This is each dose of walking through the scanner at the airport would be about 1/1,000th of a chest x-ray. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very, very tiny.
And you cite one company that says the technology is completely safe, but other researchers have voiced concerns. What are the concerns?
Well, the concerns are particularly for pregnant women, or that is for fetuses. Is there any safe level of radiation for a fetus, for children, and for people with certain genes? And many of these people wouldn't know that they had these genes. For instance, people with the BRCA1 and 2 genes, which raise the risk of breast cancer, and people with a mutated form of a gene called ATM for ataxia telangiectasia. Those people are at extra risk of radiation, and you know, hardly anybody with these genes knows that they had them.
I had not heard of that.
I know.
Well, so now researchers and the government are trying to weigh the benefits and the risks. What's that equation?
Well, it's not an entirely rational equation. The benefits are, obviously, if we could catch terrorists and prevent 9/11s from happening again, that would be great. The risk is that even this extra small dose of radiation might not be worth it if, say, one extra person dies because of the radiation.
And what about just the human reaction to being asked to do yet one more screening? I mean, aren't some people, even if they're convinced, even if they're told that it's perfectly safe, aren't there going to be people who just aren't going to want to do it?
Yes. I mean, I think some are going to want to and say, okay, if this is what we have to do to feel safe, I'm game. And others will say, no way. And obviously, you can't have a screening system that lets some people opt out, because once people start opting out, then you're not screening everybody.
And again, because we probably can't say it enough, what are researchers saying about the risks? I mean, how often would you have to fly to get in an area where you're at risk?
They are saying you could fly basically as much as you wanted. You could be scanned 2,500 times a year and not be at any significant added risk. That's a lot, even for frequent flyers or pilots or stewardesses.
Unless, of course, you're one of those people that might have a reaction and be radio sensitive. So for them, and because of these privacy issues, researchers are looking at alternatives to X-rays. What are some of those?
High-frequency microwaves is one, and personally, I don't know what the added risks of that might be. Then there's another little machine that blows puffs of air at your clothing to dislodge chemicals and then analyzes the trace chemicals in the air. So there are other things cooking.
Oh, joy, a wind tunnel to get on a plane. Well, here and now is Judy Foreman. Her syndicated column on X-ray security systems appears in newspapers today, or you can read it at our website, here-now.org. Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, reviewing our top story. The death toll from Sunday's tsunami has risen to 44,000 as aid workers discover the extent of destruction in remote areas in the Indian Ocean. The deadly wave of water traveled as far as 3,000 miles from Sunday's earthquake epicenter, killing an estimated 111 people on the east coast of Africa. In Kenya, boats were tossed about like matchsticks. In Sri Lanka today, the Air Force evacuated former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl from his vacation hotel. Sri Lankan government officials now say the death toll in their country could reach 20,000. And bristling at criticism from the United Nations that U.S. aid was selfish, Secretary of State Colin Powell pledged another $20 million of help in addition to an initial $15 million. At least 11 Americans are known dead as a result of the tsunami, and 100 more are feared missing. For 35 years, an 8 foot 2 big yellow bird has built his home on Sesame Street.
Well, I'm not all alone. Why, there's Gordon and Susan.
But they're not birds like we are.
I know, but they're nice people.
But you should have a home and a family.
Well, I am home. I like it here on Sesame Street.
When Big Bird was born, Jim Henson's Muppets were already huge stars. When Jim Henson died, it was Big Bird who sang at his funeral. And while Big Bird and his neighbor Oscar the Grouch may not share the same outlook on life, they have the same heart and soul. A guy named Carol Spinney. Carol's new book is called The Wisdom of Big Bird and the Dark Genius of Oscar the Grouch, Lessons from a Life in Feathers. And Carol joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hi there, Robin.
I read in your book that Big Bird started out as kind of a local yokel. And when did he become a child?
Well, it wasn't long that he was a local yokel. Jim Henson had personally discovered me doing my own show called Pickle Puss and Friends. To me, it was like if I was a drummer, he'd say, I've got a little band from Liverpool. Would you like to be me drummer then? And it was Jim Henson asking me. I couldn't believe it. He built the bird around me, and he asked, I asked him, what is he like? And he said, gee, I've been thinking of him as a puppet, but I haven't thought who he's going to be. He said, well, maybe it's like a nice, amiable, goofy guy like Goofy, Mickey Mouse's pal. And we weren't doing the show very long before I said, you know, I think it'd be better if he were a child, because he's trying to learn the alphabet, and he wanted to join a bunch of little kids in a daycare center in one of our scenes. And I said, I don't think you'd want him there as Goofy, but I think he might be there as a child who hasn't learned much yet, even though he's 8 feet, too.
I also I just worshiped Jim Henson, and his passing was just horrendous. And so I was devastated to read that he wasn't all that sentimental about
the characters. Well, I'm almost sorry I put it that way, because it sounds like he was cold. There was nothing cold about him. He just was he was a true genius.
But he was surprised that you talked to the
pockets,
well,
if you will.
Well, I guess I'm a little silly maybe, but Ernie, he had to drop on the floor because he had a quick change to another puppet. And so Ernie was in his way, and he kind of shoved him aside with his foot. And I picked Ernie up and said, gee, Ernie, he didn't mean that. And he said, why, are you sentimental about the puppets? And I said, well, yeah, I guess if the character that you build for them eventually becomes quite real to you.
Yeah. And is that, does that say something about you and what you brought to Big Bird? Because you've said that the most important component of Big Bird to you is compassion.
Well, that's what I've kind of developed. First he became the child, and he was kind of sweet and amiable. And he also was able to get angry and pout and do all the things that kids can do. But one day, actually, I was walking back from Sesame Street, and this little old man, he looked kind of upset. And he was standing there, and I said, is there anything wrong, sir? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I haven't been well, and I'm living alone. And if I fall, there's no one to take care of me. I said, well, would you like to take my arm? And I walked him a few blocks, and he thanked me. The next day, I just couldn't get it out of my mind, and I went to work the next day, and I suggested to one of our producers, couldn't Big Bird do something to teach compassion?
Yeah.
And she said, well, maybe you could just put it into his character. About 3 years later, I was reading a newspaper telling about the different characters. He said, and then there's the compassionate Big Bird. And I said, yes, success. I must have done something right.
And it is. It's Big Bird that cries with Mr. Snuffleupagus when they have discussion about whether or not they can have imaginary friends, turn out not to be imaginary, and it's Big Bird that cries when he learns that Mr. Hooper has died, and all the children watching learn. I'm getting a little choked up when I talk about it. You know, so it's Big Bird that brought those moments to us.
Yes, and it was, that was, I realized I'd gone a long way from just being, you know, I was Grandma Nellie the clown on Bozo Show.
Well, you know, it's the most amazing thing. Everywhere Big Bird is, you are. It's just the weirdest thing. And so I'm wondering, is Big Bird here now?
I'll see. Big Bird?
What is it?
Come here a minute.
Oh, hi. Who's this?
Hi, Big Bird. It's Robin.
Oh, hello, Robin. You don't look like a bird.
That's right. You're the bird. You're a Big Bird. How old are you?
Well, I'm 6 now. Bird years, though. Oh, not quite the same as yours.
No. Well, Big Bird, I know you've been doing a lot of interviews along with your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Big Bird, what's the silliest thing people are asking you? Because people can ask the silliest things.
Well, this morning, somebody asked me all about what's my opinion about dating.
Oh.
I didn't know what that word means.
When they tell you about the birds and the... Oh, wait, you already know about the birds.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Oscar, get out of the... He's in your wastebasket. Oscar.
No.
Hey, look, I'm looking for good stuff in here. I love trash.
Hi, Oscar.
We all know that, Oscar.
Oscar, you know what I want to know? Oscar, are you really as grouchy as people say?
I'm a little grouchier than that. Particularly today, I got up on the right side of the bed. Oh. I hate that.
Yeah. Big Bird, how do you... You know, Oscar sometimes can be so grouchy, and, you know, he's making a mess right now in our garbage can.
Oscar, you're making a mess.
Good.
How do you feel about that, Big Bird? Sometimes he's kind of rude.
Yeah, but he's nice. I kind of like most people. He just pulls lots of tricks on me. And he also calls me an overgrown bag of giblets.
Hey, I'm glad to make you unhappy. Oscar, you want to make him unhappy? Well, not exactly. I like to frustrate the turkey.
I'm not a turkey!
Okay, all right. No, we're not going to fight. Do you find yourself talking to Big Bird and Oscar a lot?
Yeah, I often feel that Big Bird is sort of like a little boy to me. I'm glad to know him. Mm. And he's not me, but yet I seem to feel I know him very well, and I have a very fatherly feeling towards him.
Yeah.
Me too?
No, not you.
Well, we want to thank you for bringing him and Oscar to us. I mean, you know, it's funny. Some people have their inner child, and Big Bird and Oscar have their inner adult.
Yeah, I guess they do.
That's you. Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
Bye.
Bye.
Have a rotten day.
Carol Spinney, author of the book The Wisdom of Big Bird and the Dark Genius of Oscar the Grouch, Lessons from a Life in Feathers. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Special thanks to Emiko Tamagawa and Rachel Guberman. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our newscast producer is Jeremy Hobson. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.